Chapter 34. Old Man River. For Churchill, the challenge of selling the destroyers for bases deal to the House of Commons rankled anew. Roosevelt had declined his proposal that both countries framed the deal as the spontaneous result of a mutual wish to help each other. In the judgment of the State Department, American neutrality laws made it utterly impossible to make a spontaneous gift of the destroyers or pretty much anything else. There had to be some sort of this-for-that payment. Killing the deal was out of the question. Britain's maritime losses were mounting. In the preceding 6 weeks, 81 merchant ships had been sunk by submarines, mines, and aircraft. And this was just one theatre of a fast-expanding world conflagration. It was clear by now that the Luftwaffe was waging all-out war against the RAF, and equally clear that, despite RAF successes in the air, the intensity of German raids and the precision brought by beam navigation had begun doing serious damage to British air bases and to Lord Beaverbrook's network of aircraft factories. Invasion seemed not just likely, but imminent. So real a prospect that no one would have been surprised to look up and see German paratroopers drifting past Nelson's column in Trafalgar Square. Citizens brought gas masks to church and began wearing small metal identity discs on bracelets, in case they got blown into unidentifiable pieces. Civil defense pamphlets arrived in mailboxes, describing what to do if a panzer tank appeared in the neighborhood. One tip, jab a crowbar into the point where the tank's steel tread passed over a guide wheel. Seeing no other choice, Churchill accepted Roosevelt's position, but resolved to use his own approach in describing the deal to Parliament and the public. He planned a lengthy speech on the war situation, in which he would include his first formal remarks on the agreement. He worked on the speech throughout the afternoon of Monday, August 19th. When John Colville read the initial draft, he realized he had heard bits of it before, as Churchill tested ideas and phrases in the course of ordinary conversation. The Prime Minister also kept snippets of poems and biblical passages in a special Keep Handy file. "It is curious," Colville wrote, "to see how, as it were, he fertilizes a phrase or a line of poetry for weeks and then gives birth to it in a speech." The next morning, Tuesday, Churchill worked on it some more, but found his concentration broken by the sound of hammering coming from construction underway in the Horse Guards Parade, where workers were busy shoring up the Cabinet War Rooms, later named the Churchill War Rooms, situated in the basement of a large government office building, a short walk from No. 10 Downing Street. At 9 a.m, he ordered Colville to find the source and stop it. "This is an almost daily complaint," Colville wrote, "and must cause considerable delay in the measures being taken to defend Whitehall." Every day, some new obstacle arose to thwart Lord Beaverbrook's production goals. U-boats sank ships loaded with vital parts, tools and raw materials. Bombs fell on factories. Frightened workers walked off the job. False alarms shut down plants for hours. The Luftwaffe, aware of this, routinely sent solo bombers over factory districts to set off air raid sirens, causing Beaverbrook endless exasperation. And now even God threatened to upset his plans. On Tuesday, August 20th, the Church of England proposed that all munitions plants close for a national day of prayer, to be held 3 weeks hence, on Sunday, September 8th, 1940, to mark the passage of a year of war. A previous day of prayer had been held on May 26th, when British troops seemed on the verge of being exterminated at Dunkirk. The church wanted to give all factory workers a chance to attend church. "We feel that the material loss would be small, while the spiritual gain would be incalculable," wrote Herbert Upward, editor of the church's newspaper, in a letter to the Prime Minister. Churchill rejected a total shutdown, but agreed that factories should reconfigure their hours on that Sunday, so that workers had time in the morning or evening to go to church, which irked Beaverbrook no end. "We have already many interruptions to contend with," he complained to Churchill, citing his usual tormentors, air raids, air raid sirens, and Labour Minister Ernest Bevin, a former union organiser. "I hope very much that these troubles will not be reinforced by Providence." But, he wrote, "since the workers in the munitions factory should have the same opportunity to pray against the enemy as anyone else, Perhaps the clergy could be brought to the works instead of taking the workers to the churches. Such a decision would ensure more widespread invocations, and they should be no less effective. In London, on Tuesday, August 20th, Churchill began his war situation speech at 3:52 p.m., before a House of Commons made sleepy by the August heat. He made no mention of the destroyers at all, only the leases, couching these as an act of goodwill on the part of his government meant to address Roosevelt's anxiety about American security in the North Atlantic and the West Indies. To hear Churchill tell it, the offer of the leases was simply a magnanimous act to help out a friend and likely future ally. There is, of course, no question of any transference of sovereignty, Churchill assured the House. He portrayed the lease grants as having a value for Britain far greater than what the actual details might at first indicate. He pitched them as a kind of maritime engagement ring that enmeshed the interests of Britain and America. Undoubtedly, he said, this process means that these two great organizations of the English-speaking democracies, the British Empire and the United States, will have to be somewhat mixed up together in some of their affairs for mutual and general advantage. He told the House that he had no misgivings about this, an arch comment, given that he wanted nothing more than for the United States to be wholly, utterly mixed up in the war, ideally as a full-fledged combatant. And even if he did have concerns, he said, the process of enmeshment would continue regardless. I could not stop it if I wished. No one can stop it. Like the Mississippi, it just keeps rolling along. Let it roll, he said, as he brought his speech rumbling to an end. Let it roll on full flood, inexorable, irresistible, benignant to broader lands and better days. Churchill was pleased with the speech. Throughout the drive back to 10 Downing Street, he sang an exuberant but off-key rendition of Old Man River. To Colville, however, the speech lacked Churchill's usual verve. On the whole, except for bright patches, the speech seemed to drag, and the House, which is not used to sitting in August, was languid. What most drew the members' interest, Colville noted, was the closing portion about the island bases. Yet this was also the speech in which Churchill, while lauding the achievements of the RAF, offered what history would later appraise as one of the most powerful moments in oratory, the very line Churchill had tried out in the car with Pug Ismay during the fierce air battles of the previous week. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. Like many other diarists of the era, Colville made no reference to the line in his diary. He wrote later that it did not strike me very forcibly at the time. More important to Colville, as far as diary-worthy matters were concerned, was a dinner date that night at a restaurant called Mirabel, where he dined with Audrey Paget, a young woman who, as his dream of marrying Gay Margesson faded, had begun increasingly to draw his attention, even though she was only 18 years old. What made this new flirtation still more problematic was that Audrey was a daughter of Lord Queenborough, not to be confused with Bessborough, a conservative MP with fascist leanings. He was considered a tragic figure. He had longed for a son, but his first marriage to an American woman yielded only two daughters. His second marriage, again to an American, brought him three more daughters, including Audrey, all, in Colville's words, exceptionally pretty. Their mother, Edith Starr Miller, seemed a match for Queenborough. An anti-Semite, she described herself as an international political investigator and wrote a 700-page volume entitled Occult Theocracy, in which she sought to expose an international conspiracy by Jews, Freemasons, the Illuminati and others, to penetrate, dominate, and destroy not only the so-called upper classes, but also the better portion of all classes. To Colville, entranced by a young woman's beauty, none of this seemed to matter. In his diary, he described Audrey as very attractive and refreshing with her enthusiasm for life and her passion for enjoyment. She has plenty of conversation, and though strikingly ingenue, is evidently not stupid. She was also, he noted elsewhere, seductively pretty. Now, on that strangely warm night of Tuesday, August 20th, Colville found himself delighting in a dinner alone with Audrey, interrupted at one point when Lord Kemsley, owner of the Sunday Times, stopped by their table and, with no preamble, handed Colville a giant cigar. After dinner, Colville took Audrey to Wyndham's Theatre on Charing Cross Road to watch a play, Cottage to Let, a comic spy thriller. They closed the evening at a nightclub, The Slippin', an unfortunate choice. Colville found it empty, dull and sordid. But he was enthralled by Audrey. We flirted more brazenly than ever, and at one moment it looked like becoming more than a flirtation. But I feel a little conscience-stricken about committing the crime for which Socrates was condemned, a reference to Audrey's youth. Colville was all of 25. Chapter 35. Berlin. In Berlin on that Tuesday, August 20th, Hitler expressed his disappointment that the Luftwaffe had not yet fulfilled Hermann Göring's promise to gain air superiority over England. He told his headquarters staff, "The collapse of England in the year 1940 is under present circumstances no longer to be reckoned on." But he made no move to cancel Operation Sea Lion, the invasion of England, now set for September 15th. Göring still believed that his air force alone could bring England to heel, and blamed his own fighter squadrons for lacking the courage and skill to protect his bomber force. On Tuesday, he ordered his officers to finish off the RAF once and for all through ceaseless attacks. London itself remained off-limits by Hitler's explicit command. Over the next several nights, Göring's bombers and fighters flew thousands of sorties over England, so many aircraft from so many directions that at times they threatened to overwhelm England's coastal radar network and the ability of RAF trackers to accurately dispatch squadrons to meet them. And then, on the night of Saturday, August 24th, came a navigational error destined to change the nature of the entire war. A piece of carelessness that Basil Collier, a leading Battle of Britain historian, pegs as the moment that set the world inexorably on the march toward Hiroshima. Chapter 36. Tea time. But first came tea, to which the prof now turned his attention. His enemies made him out to be a statistical incubus who lived a life stripped clean of warmth and compassion. In fact, he often did kind things for employees and strangers, preferring to keep his role in such deeds secret. In one case, he paid the medical bills of a young female employee of his laboratory who suffered a fractured skull when, under blackout conditions, she rode her bicycle into a hole on her way to work. Upon hearing that an elderly former nurse had fallen upon evil days, as a charitable organization put it, he established a pension for the woman. He was especially generous with his valet, Harvey. On one occasion, Lindemann gave him a motorcycle, but then, worried that Harvey would get hurt in an accident, he provided a car to use instead. He expressed broader concerns as well. Despite his standoffishness and his love of fine things, his big cars, his chocolates, his Merton coats, the prof often demonstrated a caring for the common man's experience of the war. Such was the case that summer when he wrote to Churchill to oppose a proposal by the Ministry of Food to reduce the ration of tea to a mere 2 ounces a week. The one universal balm for the trauma of war was tea. It was the thing that helped people cope. People made tea during air raids and after air raids and on breaks between retrieving bodies from shattered buildings. Tea bolstered the network of 30,000 observers who watched for German aircraft over England, operating from 1,000 observation posts, all stocked with tea and kettles. Mobile canteens dispensed gallons of it, steaming from spigots. In propaganda films, the making of tea became a visual metaphor for carrying on. Tea acquired almost a magical importance in London life, according to one study of London during the war, and the reassuring cup of tea actually did seem to help cheer people up in a crisis. Tea ran through mass observation diaries like a river. "That's one trouble about the raids," a female diarist complained. "People do nothing but make tea and expect you to drink it." Tea anchored the day, though at tea time Churchill himself did not actually drink it, despite reputedly having said that tea was more important than ammunition. He preferred whiskey and water. Tea was comfort and history. Above all, it was English. As long as there was tea, there was England. But now the war and the strict rationing that came with it threatened to shake even this most prosaic of pillars. The prof saw danger. "The wisdom of a 2-ounce tea ration is open to serious doubt," Lindemann wrote in a memorandum to Churchill. "A large proportion of the population, consisting of the working-class women, who do all their own housework, and charwomen, rely exclusively on tea for stimulant. It would be an understatement to call tea their principal luxury. It is their sole luxury. It was customary for such people to keep a kettle on hand at all times," he wrote, "and to prepare a cup of tea once every couple of hours. Frequent air raid warnings," he wrote, "are likely to strengthen the appetite. Limiting this luxury could have far-reaching consequences," he warned. "It is this class which suffers most from the war. They meet the direct impact of high prices and scarcities. The blackout and, in certain cases, evacuation impose further hardships, and they lack the compensation of new interests and adventure. This class of tea drinkers was also the least educated and least responsible in the country," Lindemann wrote. "They have little stake in the good things of a free democratic community. They can say with some truth, and often do say, that it would make no difference to them if Hitler were in charge. Tea underpinned morale. If the whole of this class lost heart completely, they might infect their menfolk and undermine morale, especially if intense air bombardment added to their present troubles." In this case, Lindemann's intercession did not succeed, despite his direct connection to Churchill. The tea ration, eventually raised to 3 ounces a week, would remain in effect until 1952. In the meantime, people dried their used tea leaves so they could steep them again. Chapter 37. The Lost Bombers. On the night of Saturday, August 24th, a formation of German bombers lost its way. Their intended targets were aircraft factories and an oil depot east of London, over which the crews believed they were now flying. In fact, they were over London itself. The RAF tracked the planes from the moment they left France, but could do nothing to stop them. As yet, the British had no effective means for intercepting intruders after dark. Although ground radar could direct a fighter to a bomber's general location, it offered imprecise details about the plane's altitude and whether it was just one bomber or one of a fleet of 20. About 4 minutes elapsed between the time a plane was first detected and when its coordinates were plotted by fighter command controllers, during which time the enemy aircraft would have moved well across the channel and to a different altitude. Pilots needed to see their targets in order to attack. The RAF was struggling to modify aircraft for fighting at night and to equip them with experimental air-to-air radar. So far, however, these efforts had proven ineffective. Researchers were also racing to find ways of jamming and bending German navigational beams. The first jammers were crude modifications of medical devices used in the practice of diathermy, the application of electromagnetic energy for treatment of various conditions. By August, these had been largely supplanted by more effective jammers and by a system for masking the German beacons, meekening, and retransmitting them to confuse or divert the bombers following them. But these measures were just beginning to show promise. Otherwise, the RAF relied on barrage balloons and anti-aircraft guns guided by searchlights. The guns at this point were almost comically inaccurate. A study by the Air Ministry would soon find that only one enemy aircraft was downed for every 6,000 shells fired. As the bombers approached, sirens began to sound throughout London. On the steps of St. Martin in the Fields, a radio reporter for CBS News, Edward R. Murrow, began a live broadcast. "This," he said, his voice deep, his tone composed, "is Trafalgar Square." From where he stood, Murrow told his audience he was able to see Nelson's column and the Admiral's statue on top. "That noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of air raid sirens," he said. A searchlight came on in the distance, then another closer at hand, behind Nelson's statue. Murrow paused to let listeners hear the chilling contrapuntal wail of several sirens as they filled the night with sound. Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner, he said. Double-deckers they are, just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes. Another bus passed. More searchlights came on. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. The traffic signal turned red, the light barely visible through the cross-shaped aperture of blackout plates installed over the bulbs. Incredibly, under the circumstances, the traffic came to an obedient stop. I'll just ooze down in the darkness here along these steps and see if I can pick up the sound of people's feet as they walk along, Murrow said. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, is just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes. In the background, the sirens wobbled continuously up and down the scale, before at last dying away, leaving London under a state of alert pending the sounding of the all-clear signal. During the broadcast, Murrow did not see or hear any explosions, but just east of where he stood, bombs began to fall onto neighbourhoods in central London. One damaged St. Giles's Church in Cripplegate, others fell on Stepney, Finsbury, Tottenham, Bethnal Green, and adjacent neighbourhoods. The damage was minimal, casualties few, but the raid sent a tremor of terror throughout the city. No one in England knew as yet that the bombs were strays, dropped in error against Hitler's explicit orders, or that early on Sunday morning Göring sent an irate message to the bomber wing involved, saying, "It is to be reported forthwith which crews dropped bombs in the London prohibited zone. The Supreme Commander, Göring, reserves to himself the personal punishment of the commanders concerned by remustering them to the infantry." To Londoners, the attack seemed to herald a new phase of the war. For mass observation diarist Olivia Cockett, it conjured visions of fresh horrors ahead. I suppressed a horrid fantasy of fears on the lines of sewers and water mains gone, gas gone. Daren't drink water, typhoid. Then gas from cruising planes, and nowhere to go. Endless possibilities of horrors, difficult to dismiss during those listening hours in the night. She experienced mounting anxiety. My heart misses a beat whenever a car changes gear up, or when someone runs, or walks very quickly, or suddenly stands still, or cocks their head on one side, or stares up at the sky, or says shh, or whistles blow, or a door bangs in the wind, or a mosquito buzzes in the room. So, taken all round, my heart seems to miss more beats than it ticks. The Saturday night raid on London infuriated Churchill, but it also eased his growing frustration at not being able to go on the offensive and bring the war to Germany itself. The RAF had already bombed industrial and military targets along the Ruhr River and elsewhere, but these had minimal impact in terms of both damage and psychological effect. The attack on London gave him the pretext he had been waiting for, moral justification for an attack on Berlin itself. Chapter 38. Berlin. The next night, at 12:20 a.m., Berliners were shocked to hear air raid sirens go off throughout the city as British bombers droned overhead, a scenario their leaders had assured them was impossible. Anti-aircraft guns tore the sky apart. "The Berliners are stunned," correspondent Scheider wrote the next day. "They did not think it could happen. When this war began, Göring assured them it couldn't. He boasted that no enemy planes could ever break through the outer and inner rings of the capital's anti-aircraft defense. The Berliners are a naive and simple people." They believed him. The raid caused only minor damage and killed no one, but it posed a fresh challenge for Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels. The wildest rumors had begun circulating, he told the attendees at his morning meeting. One rumor making the rounds held that the paint on British bombers had somehow made them invisible to searchlights. How else could they have made it to Berlin without being shot down? Goebbels instructed that rumors were to be countered with a precise statement, setting out in detail how little damage had been done. He advocated more forceful action as well. "Unofficial measures are to be taken by way of the party to ensure that rumour mongers from among the decent circles of the population are dealt with rigorously and on occasion, if necessary, can even be roughed up." Chapter 39 Our Youth. That Hitler would retaliate seemed a certainty, and given Germany's penchant for massed raids, the attack was likely to be a big one. Thus, when air raid sirens sounded in London on the following Monday morning, August 26th, Churchill ordered John Colville and everyone else at 10 Downing Street to go into the building's air raid shelter. The alert proved to be a false alarm. Churchill knew that the RAF planned a raid on Leipzig that night, but he felt Leipzig was a pale target. He telephoned Sir Cyril Newell, chief of the air staff, to express his displeasure. "Now that they have begun to molest the capital," Churchill told him, "I want you to hit them hard, and Berlin is the place to hit them." The siren sounded in London again that night, just as Colville was finishing dinner with a friend, a member of the King's Guard, in the guard's dining room at St. James's Palace. The men had moved on to cigars. A bagpiper was marching around the table playing Speed, Bonny Boat. At the sound of the alert, the men calmly put out their cigars and moved to the palace shelter, where they changed from their formal blue dining uniforms into battle dress and helmets. No bombs fell, but the alert continued. At length, Colville left and made his way back to 10 Downing. By 12:30 a.m., the all-clear still had not sounded. Now and then Colville heard airplane engines and the sharp report of anti-aircraft guns. Churchill, still up and active, again ordered his staff to the shelter, but he himself remained at work, along with Colville, the prof, and several other officials and secretaries. At one point, finding himself in the rare position of having nothing to do, Colville walked into the walled garden at the back of the house. The night was soft, suffused with mist, rising from the warm city around him. Searchlights cast pillars of pale light far into the sky. Only a few aircraft had come and still no bombs had fallen, but the mere presence of the planes had shut down the city. This made for an oddly serene moment. I stood in the garden, heard midnight strike on Big Ben, watched the searchlight display and wondered at the unaccustomed stillness of London. Not a sound, and scarcely a breath of air. Then suddenly the noise of an engine and the flash of a distant gun. Churchill changed into his night clothes and, carrying a helmet, came downstairs in what Colville described as a particularly magnificent golden dragon dressing gown. He too entered the garden, where he paced back and forth for a time, a stubby round figure in flaming gold, until he at last moved down to the shelter to spend the night. Churchill slept well, not even waking when the all-clear sounded at 3:45 a.m. He always slept well. His ability to sleep anywhere, anytime, was his particular gift. Wrote Pug Ismay, his capacity for dropping off into a sound sleep the moment his head touched the pillow had to be seen to be believed. Not so for Colville, who, like many others in London, having managed finally to fall asleep after the initial alert, was awakened by the steady one-note wail of the all-clear. This, Colville wrote, is the double sting about air raids at night. Among the public at large, for the moment, morale remained high, at least as gauged by a postal and telegraph censorship department study of mail bound for America and Ireland, intercepted and read by the Bureau. The report, released on Friday, August 30th, quoted a correspondent from North Wembley who wrote, "I would not be anywhere in the world but here for our fortune." The censors claimed to have detected a paradox that morale is highest in places that have been most badly bombed. Upon noting this, however, the censors' report took on a distinctly censorious tone. There is a general complaint of lack of sleep, but writers who speak of shattered nerves would appear to be people who are normally uncourageous. And where mention is made of children's terror, it would seem in most cases to be the fault of the mother. That said, the civilian districts of London and other big cities had thus far gone largely unscathed. Overnight, the RAF launched a second raid against Berlin and killed its first Berliners, 10 of them, and wounded another 21. While London braced for Hitler's reprisal, Mary Churchill and her mother were savouring the peace of a warm summer night at Breckles Hall, the country home of Mary's friend, Judy Montagu, where Mary was supposed to spend another few weeks. Clementine planned shortly to return to London. Here, in these farmish lands at the edge of Thetford Forest in Norfolk, among its 102 acres of fields, moors and pinelands, the air war, with its bombs and aerial battles, seemed especially remote as Mary recorded in her diary. The house itself dated to the mid-1500s, and was said to be visited now and then by a beautiful ghost in a coach and four, whose gaze caused instant death to anyone who gazed back. The girls rode bicycles and horses, played tennis, swam, went to the movies, and danced with airmen at nearby RAF bases, occasionally bringing them back for the now familiar snogging sessions in the hayloft, all of which prompted Mary one day to exclaim in her diary, "Ah, la jeunesse, la jeunesse." Judy's mother, Venetia, made it her mission to balance the laziness of these summer days by engaging the girls in various intellectual pursuits. She read them the works of Jane Austen, likening Mary and Judy to those giddy girls from Pride and Prejudice, Kitty and Lydia Bennet, who were forever off to Meryton to see what regiments had appeared locally, as Mary later wrote. The girls also resolved to learn the sonnets of William Shakespeare and to commit one to memory each day, a task at which they failed, though Mary would retain the ability to recite several for years afterward. Now and then the war intruded, as when her father telephoned with news about a big German raid on Ramsgate on the Strait of Dover that destroyed 700 homes. The raid was particularly intense, with 500 high-explosive bombs falling in the space of just 5 minutes. The news was jarring for Mary, who wrote, "Down here, despite air activity and especially during this lovely day, one had almost forgotten the war." The news intensified the dissonance she felt between the life she was leading at Breckles Hall and the greater reality of the war, and this prompted her, on Monday, September 2nd, to write to her mother to plead for permission to return home to London. "I am indulging in escapism down here," she wrote. "For quite a long time on end, I have forgotten the war completely. Even when we are with the airmen, one forgets, because they are so gay." With millions of people throughout Europe starving and bereaved and unhappy, she wrote, "Somehow it's all wrong. May I please come back to you and Papa as soon as possible? I really won't let the air raids rattle me, and I care so terribly about the war and everything, and I should like to feel that I was risking something." Her parents had a different, distinctly paternal view. "It makes me glad that you are having a happy, carefree spell in the country," Clementine wrote in reply. "You must not feel guilty about it. Being sad and low does not help anyone." She told Mary about life at No. 10 since the Saturday night attack. "We have got quite used to the air raid warnings, and when you come back you will find a comfortable little bunk in the shelter. There are four, one for Papa, one for me, one for you and one for Pamela," a reference to Pamela Churchill, now 8 months pregnant. "The top ones are quite difficult to climb into. Twice we have spent the whole night there, as we were asleep when the all clear went. Down there you can hear nothing." It doubtless did not help ease Mary's guilt that in this letter Clementine called her "my darling country mouse." But one visit to a nearby RAF base made Mary's pangs grow still more acute. There were the usual frivolities, lunch, tennis, tea, but then came the highlight of the whole afternoon, a tour of a Blenheim bomber. "It was thrilling," she wrote, although, she added, "it made me feel very useless. There can never be a true measure of my love for England, because I am a woman, and I feel passionately that I would like to pilot a plane or risk everything for something which I believe in so entirely and love so very deeply. Instead," she wrote, "I must lick down envelopes and work in an office and live a comfortable, happy life." With the prospect of raids on London itself, U.S. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy decamped. To the great disdain of many in London, he began conducting his ambassadorial affairs from his home in the country. Within the Foreign Office, a joke began to circulate. "I always thought my daffodils were yellow until I met Joe Kennedy." Foreign Secretary Halifax found the joke unkind, but deserved. He took a certain satisfaction from the fact that one German raid came dangerously close to destroying Kennedy's country home. Halifax, in his diary entry for Thursday, August 29th, called this a judgment on Joe. Lord Beaverbrook was tired. His asthma dogged him, and as always, he was annoyed. Annoyed that air raid sirens robbed his factories of countless hours of work, that German bombers seemed able to come and go at will, that a single bomb could knock out production for days. Still, despite all these obstacles, and although his factories were under nightly assault by the Luftwaffe, his manufacturing and salvage empire managed to produce 476 fighters in August, nearly 200 more than the total previously projected by the chiefs of staff. Lest Churchill have somehow overlooked this feat, Beaverbrook wrote to him on Monday, September 2nd, to remind him of his own success. He also took the opportunity to express a degree of self-pity as to how much struggle these gains had required, closing his note with a lyric from an American folk spiritual, "Nobody knows the trouble I've seen." By way of reply, Churchill the next day returned Beaverbrook's note with a two-word rejoinder jotted at the bottom, "I do." Chapter 40. Berlin and Washington. The attacks on Berlin did indeed enrage Hitler. On Saturday, August 31st, he shed his prior reluctance and ordered his air chief, Göring, to begin preparations for an assault on London itself. The attack, Hitler instructed, was to reduce enemy morale while still maintaining focus on targets of strategic value. He did not, as yet, wish to cause mass panic. But Hitler understood, as well as anyone, that given the inherent inaccuracy of bombing, attacks against strategic targets within London would be tantamount to targeting civilian districts outright. 2 days later, Göring issued a directive to the Luftwaffe. Once again, he envisioned a cataclysmic raid of such extraordinary proportion that Churchill would capitulate or be evicted from office. Göring craved revenge on the English for humiliating his air force, and was delighted at the prospect of unleashing the full power of his armada against the English capital. This time, he would bring Britain to heel. As Göring readied his aerial onslaught and preparations continued for the invasion of England, Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, grew increasingly concerned about the intensifying conflict. Thus far, he had made no progress in fulfilling Hitler's wish that he somehow bring about the collapse of Churchill's government. That the two empires should clash struck Hess as fundamentally wrong. On August 31st, he met with a friend and mentor, Professor Karl Haushofer, a leading political scientist whose theories informed Hitler's worldview, but whose personal life placed him on precarious ground. His wife was half-Jewish. To protect Haushofer's two sons, Hess, despite his own hatred of Jews, had declared both to be honorary Aryans. Hess and Haushofer spoke for 9 hours, during which Hess alerted his friend to the increasing likelihood that Germany would invade England. The two discussed the idea of delivering a peace proposal to London through a British intermediary, someone with close connections among appeasement-minded members of Churchill's government, with the goal of sparking a parliamentary rebellion against the Prime Minister. 3 days after this meeting, Professor Haushofer wrote a delicately worded letter to one of his sons, Albrecht, who was an important advisor to both Hitler and Hess, and an Anglophile who spoke perfect English. The elder Haushofer expressed his concerns about the looming invasion and asked his son if it might not be possible to arrange a meeting in a neutral location with an influential middleman to discuss ways of averting further conflict with England. He knew that his son had befriended a prominent Scotsman, the Duke of Hamilton, and now suggested approaching him. It was important to act quickly. "As you know," Professor Haushofer wrote, "everything is so prepared for a very hard and severe attack on the island in question that the highest-ranking person only has to press a button to set it off." In the United States, a final obstacle to the Destroyers for Bases deal was cleared when a lawyer with the State Department came up with a compromise that would let both Churchill and Roosevelt portray the arrangement in the manner each deemed most palatable to his countrymen. The Newfoundland and Bermuda bases would be classified as a gift, granted in acknowledgement of Britain's friendly and sympathetic interest in the national security of the United States. Leases on the remaining bases would serve as payment for the destroyers, but no cash value would be assigned to any particular asset, thereby limiting each side's ability to calculate comparative worth. It was clear enough that America was getting the better deal, without providing critics too easy an opportunity to demonstrate the disparity with hard numbers. And indeed, the American press hailed it as a coup for the president, the kind of hard bargain that appealed to America's sense of itself as a nation adept at doing things in a businesslike manner. As the Louisville Courier-Journal put it, We haven't had a better bargain since the Indians sold Manhattan Island for $24 in wampum and a demijohn of hard liquor. Britain's ambassador, Lord Lothian, and U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull signed the agreement on Monday, September 2nd. 2 days later, the first 8 destroyers were moored in Halifax Harbour, at which point their new British crews began to appreciate how much work was needed just to make them seaworthy, let alone battle-ready. As one American officer put it, their hulls were barely thick enough to keep out the water and small fish. For Churchill, however, the quality of the destroyers was to a large extent beside the point. As a Navy man, he had to have known that the ships were too antique to be of much use. What mattered, rather, was that he had gotten Roosevelt's attention, and perhaps nudged him a step closer to full involvement in the war. Just how much longer Roosevelt would be president, however, was an open question. The American presidential election was to take place 2 months hence, on November 5th, and Churchill fervently hoped Roosevelt would win, but this outcome was by no means certain. A Gallup poll released on September 3rd showed that 51% of Americans favored Roosevelt in the upcoming election. 49% preferred Wendell Willkie. Given margins of error in polling, the two candidates were running neck and neck. But in America, the tilt toward isolationism was gaining momentum and intensity. On September 4th, a group of Yale law students founded the America First Committee to oppose involvement in the war. The organization grew quickly, winning the energetic support of no less a celebrity than Charles Lindbergh, a national hero ever since his 1927 flight across the Atlantic. And Willkie, urged by Republican leaders to do whatever he could to pull ahead in the presidential election, was about to change strategy and make the war, and fear, the central issue in the campaign.